You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, hello, Charles. How's it going?
Back from the desert.
Yeah.
You're not really with either of us, Richard.
Well, I was going to say, where are we, Lionel?
Well, we're all in...
That's a complicated question.
It is. Daniel's back from the desert. And are you in Berlin? I'm assuming you are.
I am.
Yeah,
I am.
Berlin office of the Cycling Podcast. I'm in the not Watford office of the Cycling Podcast. And Rich, where are you?
I'm in a hotel lobby in Seville, Lionel. I'm on my way to the Ruta del Sol. We're speaking on Tuesday. The Ruta del Sol actually starts tomorrow, Wednesday. There'll be a lot of people there for Chris Froome's first race of the season. I will not actually be there. It's a complicated story. I'll not bore you with the details, but I'll not be there on day one. I'll be joining the race later in the week and we'll report.
It's not that complicated. You're on holiday.
It is quite complicated, Daniel. But we'll be reporting on the Ruta del Sol next week. We're on a bit of a time delay here, aren't we? Because this week we're reporting on the Dubai Tour. Next week we'll report on the Ruta del Sol, and in August we'll report on the Tour de France.
What do you think? Our time lag will just get progressively worse over the year?
Yeah, I think we should do the tour this year on a sort of delay. Don't you think? It's counterintuitive. Mm. Nobody else is doing it.
Yeah, I mean, people get kind of tour withdrawal symptoms after the season's ended. Maybe that would be the best time to put out all our tour coverage.
Yeah. Why just do what everybody else is doing?
Lionel, you and I worked for magazines which did that for about 20 years. Yeah. So it's not that revolutionary.
That's very true. When I first bought Winning magazine, you'd get the sort of September edition, and it would be doing the Giro. That's how long the lead times were on production of magazines on cycling in the 80s.
And as Matt White told us when he was over just before Christmas, they used to get the Tour de France issue of Winning magazine or whatever magazine it was in September in Australia. So, yeah, it's been done before.
It's difficult, isn't it? My dislike of any kind of speculation means we can't talk about anything that might happen or might not happen. Nothing in the future is allowed to be discussed. And now we're covering things a week after they've actually occurred. Cutting edge.
Anyway, let's bring things right up to date with your weekly news roundup, Lionel.
Thank you, Rich. Well, there's lots of stage racing going on at the moment. Big blocks of stage racing before Het Nieuwsblad and the proper start of the season in a couple of weekends' time. The Dubai Tour, where Daniel was, that finished with stage wins for a couple of Italian riders, Sonny Colbrelli and Elia Viviani, with Viviani taking the overall title. Really impressed by the photography coming from the Oro y Paz stage race in Colombia. It looked like huge crowds were there to watch what is a brand new race. There were stage victories there for Julian Alaphilippe, Rigoberto Urán, and Quintana's off the mark. No, not Nairo, but his younger brother Dea. And Egan Bernal, Team Sky's new Colombian rider, first year professional, won the overall title there. And that's certainly an event to keep an eye on in coming years. I think that's only going to get bigger. Couple of one-day races in Europe at the weekend. Caleb Ewan won the Clásica de Almería in southern Spain, not that far from where you are, Rich. And Moreno Moser won the...
Good to know that he re-entered the Earth's atmosphere, Caleb Ewan, after last week's mishap.
Oh dear, trampolined into space by Marcel Kittel. If you didn't listen to last week's news roundup, that will be completely lost on you, so you'll have to go back and listen to
it's
that.
It's completely lost on me, Lionel.
Well, we know, Daniel, you don't listen to the podcast, only your bits. I don't know how do you edit us out when you listen back? Just kind of mute when we start talking and then unmute when you start talking again? I don't know.
It's very much like normal conversations with you, yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Moreno Moser won the Trofeo Laguaglia, which is on Italy's Ligurian coast. And that's kind of, it's one of the little towns on the Milan-San Remo route, I think, isn't it? Once it hits the coast and then goes through all those little towns. Milan-San Remo also on the horizon. We'll talk a little bit about that later on in the episode. Meanwhile, in the south of France, Alexandre Genier won the Tour La Provence ahead of Tony Galopin. It was a very French affair, that race. 14 of the top 15 were from the host nation. Another Frenchman celebrating is Brian Coquard, not celebrating the fact that his team has been missed out on the wild cards for the Tour de France. France, but celebrating the stage win on the first day of the Tour of Oman. And we'll update on that next week, along with the Ruta del Sol. Richard, you'll have a dispatch from there, and Chris Froome's return to racing. The Tour of the Algarve is also kicking off. So a real busy week of racing coming up. But it's been all about the sprinters and the Dubai Tour in the last 7 days, really.
Yeah, so you're just back from Dubai, Daniel. We'll talk about that in a moment, and we'll hear a couple of interviews later on. I mean, interesting, you mentioned Brian Cocar winning in Oman. Big win for his new team. And he will not ride the Tour, as you said, Lionel. Controversial omission. And on the subject of wildcards, we're going to hear from Rick Delaney, the owner of the Aqua Blue Sports team, in part three. Had some fairly forthright things to say about the business of selection of teams for races. So what takeaways from the desert this time, Daniel? I think this was your second time out there, wasn't it? You were there last year, am I right in thinking that?
I was at the Tour of Abu Dhabi last year. Same organisation, similar part of the world.
Any cocktails with Graham Bartlett this time around?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because we're going to hear from... it's become a bit of a theme. Daniel's cocktails in the desert with wealthy impresarios. Last year it was Graham Bartlett. I don't know if he's a wealthy impresario. He's a fairly important, respectable man. And this year it was Rick Delaney, the owner of the Aqua Blue team. We're going to come on to that, aren't we? Dubai Tour, won by Elia Viviani. It was interesting, first time I've been to Dubai, not necessarily the kind of place that I would gravitate towards. You know, I'm a man of the natural world, as you guys know.
You can't get much more natural than a desert.
Well, I very much enjoy the desert. The race was...
Is it the skyscrapers you don't
like? Well, it's the skyscrapers and it's the air pollution mainly, Lionel. Mm. Although even that is a contentious issue. You know, there are reports that say that... air quality is awful, awful in Dubai, and others.
Some spectacular desert landscape, some not spectacular desert landscape. But there was a bit of, you know, almost mountains. Are any of those going to feature in Mountain Highest?
Well,
the next volume.
Well, no, Rich. But actually, on one of the mornings in Dubai, I did speak to the director of the man in charge of the Dubai Sports Council, who's basically the man behind the Dubai Tour. And he suggested, well, not only did he tell me that his ambition is for the Dubai Tour to be as big as the Tour de France, so, you know, we can all look forward to 3 weeks of stages through the desert. He also suggested that possibly next year the race might go into the mountains in the north of the country, and maybe even to onto a road called, I think it's called Jebel Jais. And it goes up to about 1,900 meters, and it's a very sort of photogenic climb in the desert, in the mountains bordering Oman. So that's something to look forward to. The race itself, very well organized, great system whereby each team has a sort of pit, a kind of corrugated iron pit, down on the seafront in Dubai, and the stages start every day from the same place, and the mechanics can use these pits throughout the week, which is...
I thought you were going to say they're a great system whereby each team gets a stage win, which did look to be on the cards at one point last week.
And the riders themselves, they were raving about the race and the organisation, and obviously the hotels are pretty opulent, as you would expect. And, you know, I enjoyed the sprint finishes. I mean, generally speaking, I do enjoy sprint finishes. I don't necessarily enjoy the 180 kilometres, 170 kilometre prelude every day, but I thought there was a lot to take away from the sprint finishes last week. You know, riders experimenting with new trains, experimenting with new methods going into the sprints. Some flickers of controversy, courtesy of Mark Cavendish a couple of days, you know, about his bike, about rule changes that weren't actually rule changes, which were actually sort of backhanded swipes at Peter Sagan, hangovers from last year at the Tour de France. So, you know, there was a lot going on. And then the winner, Viviani, really, well, suggesting that he might step up this year and really join the sprinters' jet set after several years in the supporting cast, I suppose, of world sprinting.
And Marcel Kittel, you know, how did he feel about it? He gave you the brush off, I think, didn't he?
He did. I think he was just. I don't think it was anything personal, Rich. I don't. I know you would love.
I wasn't suggesting you would love to think it was.
But no, I think he was just preoccupied. He had a lot on his mind because the train itself, Katusha's train. Obviously, Kittel has moved to a new team, Katusha, this year. The train itself, I thought, was functioning pretty well, and they were certainly very prominent at the front of the bunch on each one of the sprint finishes. But something was going wrong every day. And if you went back to analyse each of the sprints from helicopter shots in particular, what looked as though it was going wrong was that Kittel simply didn't have the legs. He was losing the wheels quite a lot. His lead out man in Dubai was Marco Haller, the Austrian rider, fellow Arsenal fan actually. I also sat next to him on the way home, on the flight home. Anyway, he was Kittel's lead out man. Sorry. Groans.
Five hours of you two talking about Arsenal. Blimey.
Groans.
The people in the row in front must have got a good nap.
But he's going to be Kittel's lead out man. Rick Zabel is also going to be part of the lead out train. And I didn't think that they were doing too much wrong. Kittel, as I said, was losing position sometimes, and I think it was that there were the kind of mistakes that someone on top form, maybe 2 or 3 months into the season, would be able to correct themselves because, you know, they would have the legs to do so. There were at least 2 days where Kittel was in a position where he had to correct mistakes, his own mistakes, and simply didn't have the legs to do it. And I don't think that's necessarily alarming at this point in the season, but what it has done, I think, is given his rivals, or the riders who are going to be his rivals for the rest of the season, a bit of a morale boost. And Mark Cavendish was positively bouncing around by the end of the week, not suggesting that was solely down to Marcel Kittel's misfortunes, but might have had something to do with it.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
We interrupt the podcast to bring you news of the Leesa mattress, the sponsor for this episode, and in a moment we'll give you details about how you can get a fantastic discount. Richard, you've been in Spain a few days away from home. Are you already missing your Leesa mattress?
I am, of course, Lionel, though I wouldn't say anything too disrespectful about the mattresses in my hotel in Seville, given that I'm currently sitting in their lobby. But yes, the Leesa mattress, which I've got at home now, is extremely comfortable. Leesa give you 100 nights to try your mattress at home, and if you're not sleeping better within those 100 nights, they will come and collect it and donate it to charity or recycle it, and you'll get a full refund.
Well, it won't surprise you to know, Rich, that sometimes I don't sleep too well. I have a lot on my mind, you know, my brain cranking over. Mm-hmm. Often wake up in the middle of the night. But I have to say, it's only taken me one night to decide that I'm keeping my Leesa mattress. I know this is a sponsored message, and we're promoting the mattresses, but I genuinely have had a great night's sleep. It's comfortable. I've not sort of rocked myself to sleep. I think I wake myself up a lot with kind of movement, but I've not had that problem.
This makes me quite worried about the Grand Tours, where you'll not be sleeping on your Leesa mattress, Lionel.
Well, does it explain a lot about my temperament at the Grand Tours? I rarely sleep well on the Grand Tours.
And your appearance some mornings.
Well, yeah. Anyway, Leesa is a company that gives a lot back. They donate one mattress to charity for every 10 mattresses sold. They give custom-made mattresses to organisations that serve the homeless and at-risk men, women and children. On their website, you'll see more details about this, as well as some case studies.
So to the exclusive offer, you can receive £80 off a Leesa mattress with the code CYCLING. Go to leesa.co.uk, that's LEESA, and enter this code CYCLING to receive £80 off your purchase. Thank you again for the support of this week's episode of the Cycling Podcast to the Leesa mattress. A better place to sleep.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits, and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Alexander, if you had to choose between winning San Remo again and Flanders again, which would you choose?
That's a hard choice, but I feel the Flanders win was harder to achieve. I think it's more likely that I win San Remo, but I was, I don't know, every year top five in the Flanders, so I don't know. But I feel I'm closer every year to win San Remo, but yeah, I was never feeling I was that close to win Flanders except the year I won it. And the other years I won the sprint in the second group, but there was still quite a long way to the win. So I think it's a bigger chance in Sanremo, but yeah, the Flanders one is maybe hangs a bit higher.
Well, we talked to Cavendish last night, and he says, bizarrely for him, since Lemania has not been on the course, it's become harder for him because it's a faster race. But I think you used to really dislike Lemania, is that right? And you much prefer it without Lemania.
Yeah, I don't know. I only did it one time with it. Okay. And actually, I made the climb, but I didn't make the downhill. And so I was the last position on the top. And in the downhill, suddenly it broke in three pieces, and I never saw the front again. So I don't have good memories from the climb, so I rather just see we skip it.
And in your team this year, you've got another rider who's got a very good record in Sanremo, not as good as yours, but Ben Swift. What role is he going to have in Sanremo, if any?
I think he will have a little bit open role because he's usually climbing a bit better than me. And like last year, I was a break going away, and if we have Ben there, he's a good guy to can finish this off. So then we have a good card to play, and if it's not, he will do a lead out for me. So he has a card there to join the attackers, and if he don't make it, he must help me at the end, I think.
Sanremo is better now than it was when I won. Like, Lemani killed it, and now it's Sanremo. Only an absolute fool thinks that more climbs make a race more interesting. There's just, like the saying about Sanremo, it's the easiest to finish, the hardest to win. There's so many people in with a shot, from attackers to sprinters. Everyone's, that's what makes it special. That's why you don't need climbs to make it. You never know the, after 300 kilometres, you don't know the outcome until the line. Anything can change before that line. That's what's so beautiful. It just builds in a crescendo till the finish line, you know? That's what it's hard to win. There's no excuses why I haven't won, why I don't think I won. I haven't won.
Thank you very much indeed to Rafa, our main sponsor at the Cycling Podcast. A reminder, you can buy your Cycling Podcast Rafa clothing at rafa.cc or click on shop at thecyclingpodcast.com. Hoping to do something in association with Rafa at our Manchester show in our forthcoming book tour. Details soon. After we heard a little bit about Rafa there, we heard from Mark Cavendish and Alexander Kristoff, two former Milan-San Remo winners. And you spoke to them out in Dubai, Daniel.
Yeah, there they were, talking about Milan-San Remo. Of course, Dubai, I suppose, starts the warm-up for Milan-San Remo. A lot of sprinters there. It was just interesting doing a bit of a straw poll of among the sprinters, who's going for it, what they're doing. Nasser Buhani, someone who is very much targeting Milan-San Remo. I think he's going to do a training camp in Italy, riding on the route for multiple days, I think, in the next couple of weeks. But Buhani was another rider who was under scrutiny in Dubai. You know, a lot of changes at Cofidis in the close season. He had his new director sportif there, Roberto Damiani, trying to tame the beast of Buhani, as it were. And he did all right on one day. He was second to Cavendish, and he was pretty pleased with that. But yeah, Kittel's also going to do Milan-San Remo, I understand. Obviously, I would say an outsider for that. But, you know, you heard Kristoff and Cavendish there talking about how they feel about this route that, you know, nowadays doesn't feature Lemania, the climb that used to come before the Capi and before the Cipressa and the Poggio. And, you know, it's looking very open. As Cavendish said there, you know, all sorts of riders performing well already. Julian Alaphilippe, who was on the podium last year, performing well in Colombia. And then, you know, we haven't really seen Peter Sagan yet, who, you know, I looked at the odds yesterday, and he's very much the hot favourite as far as the bookies are concerned.
Well, Fernando Gaviria and Julian Alaphilippe both riding in Colombia and riding extremely well, as was Viviani in Dubai. And there are three hands that Quickstep could play in that race, assuming...
Well, four, Rich. Four, because you've got Philippe Gilbert as well, who's very much targeting
him. Oh, Philippe Gilbert. I mean, it's his big aim, isn't it? How could I forget Philippe Gilbert? Well, I mean, how do you sort that one out?
Well, there were even murmurs in Dubai that Viviani was basically riding for his place in the team in San Remo and may not even be selected, despite winning in Dubai. And the other factors to take into consideration this year is that there's going to be one rider less for each team. So each team's only going to have seven riders on the start line. So it's a big risk for Quickstep to go in with essentially four leaders and only three teammates.
Why don't they have just a Quickstep only race, like in sometime in the start of March? Just everyone from Quickstep who wants to ride Milan-San Remo has to ride Milan-San Remo as a practice. First seven over the line, get in the team.
Oleg Tinkov once picked his Giro team like that, didn't he? He took them to Sardinia. He took them to Sardinia and they had a time trial. And it was the first nine riders got selected.
It's happened with other teams as well, but I just can't remember. I can't remember the context myself to get back to you on that one.
If Oleg Tinkov's done it, that is proof that it's not a ridiculous idea.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, Viviani, how, you know, Quickstep been in this position so many times. You know, Kittel came in for Cavendish. Cavendish then had to suffer the maybe not humiliation is too strong, but it can't be easy to see your replacement outperforming you. And similarly for Kittel now, seeing Viviani, you know, win a couple of stages there, and where he's struggling to get his game together, that must just add to his sense of his insecurity, I suppose. Because I do get, you talked earlier about Kittel making mistakes, Daniel, but I always get the impression that confidence is hugely important to him.
Yeah, it seems to be. It's always been kind of feast or famine in his career, or since he's been among the top sprinters. And, you know, it's intriguing that Kittel has twice now moved teams in the past couple of years and never taken, you know, a sort of battery of teammates or part of his lead out train with him. He's had to sort of learn everything from scratch in each of these new teams. And, you know, Quickstep definitely looked like the best honed lead out train in Dubai, and I think Cavendish was casting envious glances in their direction as well. He was missing Bösenhagen, who will presumably help him in lead outs at the Tour de France. He was also missing Van Rensburg, who was very impressive riding for Bösenhagen in the Tour last year. But I think he's pretty confident. He's had a good winter, Cavendish, and was very much buoyed by that one stage win in Dubai. But Kittel is going to, you know, he's got a bit of work to do, I think, sort of fine-tuning that lead-out train. Some other sprinters were also caught my eye in Dubai. Dylan Groenewegen, the atomic tadpole, as I like to call him. he is someone who's kind of gone under the radar amid all the talk about, you know, emerging sprinters and this sort of coming generation that's spearheaded by Gaviria and Caleb Ewan. Groenewegen, a lot of people forget, is only the same age as those two, and he won the first stage in Dubai. And he's someone also that, you know, going to have to look out for, even when the Tour de France comes around in July. A year more experienced. He was a bit out of his depth until he won the stage on the Champs-Élysées last year. But, yeah, he's someone I think is going to be a major factor this year in the sprints.
Very, very quick, Groenewegen. You mentioned Cavendish and him having had a good winter and feeling fairly positive about the season, Daniel. And he features in our forthcoming Friends special. Orla Shinawy went to the Isle of Man just before he left for Dubai, in fact. Cavendish was there. He's riding with the Isle of Man Commonwealth Games team. Orla spent the day with him and with the rest of the team and has put together a Friends special, really looking at the history of cycling on the Isle of Man, a small island that's produced an incredible number of top riders, obviously Cavendish foremost amongst them. So that will be released imminently. It's the finishing touches are being put to that as I speak, and that will be available to friends of the podcast. You can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Many of you have. We're very, very grateful to you for that. You helped to support us. And And a little reminder that a few of you have been kind enough to throw a bit of extra money into the pot. You can pay up to £100 to become a friend of the podcast, although it's £15 if you want to receive everything. Anything above that is entirely voluntary, and it goes to support us. If you've paid the maximum £100, you will be in contention to guest edit an extra episode this year that will also be available for friends of the podcast. So we will be contacting all those people soon and asking for your ideas. One will be chosen, and I will work with that person to produce a special episode, which will be in addition to the Friends specials. So a little reminder of that.
Unilateral announcement there, Rich. If our guest editor suddenly decide to send me to some, to do the tour of Andorra, am I allowed to say no?
Well, no, Lionel, because the editor's in charge. I mean, the editor calls the shots. Those are the sorts of ideas we'll be looking for. Absolutely. Absolutely. Great. We'll be in touch soon and asking for your ideas.
Of course, no one ever takes unilateral decisions under the current setup with the Buffalo in charge, Lionel. with our democratic democratic management structure.
No, it's very, very democratic, isn't it? I was going to mention, I mentioned at the start of this section as well, our book tour, but I'm a bit hoarse now. I've been talking a little bit too long. Lionel, do you want to remind people about our forthcoming book tour?
Certainly can, because it's looming now, isn't it? Tickets are selling well, but still availability at all of the venues. But we'd love to see as many people as possible come out and see us. Not sure, this might be our only chance to get to some of these some of the places on our tour of Britain, or tour of parts of Britain, as we've called it.
It's whether you get out of Glasgow, Lionel. Never mind.
Well, I think the people of Scotland know that my joke about the Scottish summer was just a joke. It was just a light-hearted joke.
I'm interested to see what you're going to do to try and endear yourself to them when we're in Edinburgh and Glasgow.
I'll just be my usual charming self, and everyone will be fine, I'm sure. We're in Salford on February the 28th, and then the following night we're in Edinburgh, and the night after that we are in Glasgow, and that's the sort of first leg of our tour. And then the following week, on March the 7th, we're in Nottingham. March the 8th, we're in Hackney in London. On the 9th, we are in Leeds, and on the 10th, we're in Sheffield. All the details and links to buy tickets are on thecyclingpodcast.com. Click on live events, and you'll be able to find out all the exact venues and the price and what have you. I should just say also that anyone who wants to add a copy of our new book, A Journey Through the Cycling Year, can do so and collect or pick it up on the day of the event that they're coming to.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for sponsoring us at the Cycling Podcast. Don't know if you can hear the bells of the cathedral here in Seville in the background. Atmospheric, perhaps, if not annoying. But they'll stop soon. They've gone a long time. Science in Sport offering 25% off to all listeners of the Cycling Podcast. If you go to scienceandsport.com and at the checkout enter the code SISCP25, that's available to customers in the UK and not with other offers, but 25% off with the code SISCP25. Also, a reminder that please send us any questions you have relating to nutrition, either your own or that of the pros. We'll be putting these questions to the experts at Science and Sport, who include James Morton, the team Sky nutritionist, Rob Child, who used to work for Katusha, and others. We've had some great questions so far, some of them relating to rides that you're doing, and time constraints and all other things. Anything at all, send your questions to contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, and we'll be playing some of your answers throughout the year. So please do send in some questions. I think we're going back to the desert now, aren't we, Daniel? You had cocktails with Rick Delaney. Did he pick up the tab for that, or did the Cycling Podcast pick up the tab for that?
We actually didn't stretch the cocktail. I think we had some. We might have shared a pretzel.
That's fine. We can do that. What did he have to say then?
Well, he was a very, very unhappy man, by his own admission, and so much so that after he had finished his rant, that's his words, not mine, he said, well, this will probably damage the team enormously, but I don't care. So, he was talking about wild cards for the major tours. We spoke about Giro wild cards a couple of weeks ago, in that case it was the Nippo Fantini team who we thought we were going to be very aggrieved to have missed out. Aquablue have missed out on the Tour, they've missed out on the Giro d'Italia, they've missed out on wildcards to various other one-day races, prestigious one-day races, and it looks almost certain that they're going to miss out on a wildcard at the Vuelta as well, having won a stage last year through Stefan Denifil in their first ever Grand Tour at the Vuelta. Anyway, as I said, Rich, he was not a happy man, so here's Rick Delaney.
Basically, we've got nothing. We're in a worse position this year in terms of race starts than we were this time last year. Mm. Yet we're a year older. Mm. There's no Volta this year. I mean, they've told us basically there is no start for you, and there's no Giro, obviously. And not alone is there no Giro, they gave us nothing. They gave us a week in the desert, and that's it. They've given us nothing else. 7 wild cards in Milan San Remo. We didn't get them. We got nothing. I would have thought, considering what we're trying to do in terms of being self-sufficient, what we're trying to do in the sport, take away the inconsistency of the sponsor model, I would have thought, you know, support what we're trying to do. Forget whether we win, lose or draw in terms of racing. Just try and support us because we're a good story. We're not getting the support from race organisers, and I don't know why.
Is that partly to do with the fact that your team, I mean, well, you've seen how kind of fickle it is and how parochial it is in terms of wildcards, that the teams that tend to benefit are the teams with very much kind of national interest linked to the race, you know, where the race is taking place.
Yeah, I agree with you. But in saying that, surely you do what's good for the sport. Surely we're all doing this because we love the sport and we want the sport to continue. We want the sport to be sustainable. Yeah, I get it. If you're a French team, you know, you get a French start. I get all that. But sure, you don't give it to all French. I mean, obviously, Wanty are not French, but they're borderline French. As I say, we got nothing. Paris-Nice, again, I know it's a French race, but you would think it's good for business to shove an Anglo-Saxon team in like ourselves into a race like that. We didn't get it. And Milan-San Remo, races like this, again, you would think it's good for business to put a team like us in there, because we're Anglo-Saxon, because we're trying to be self-sufficient, and because, you know, the more races we get, the more profile we get, the more hits we get in the site, the more transactions we have, the more funds come back into the team. I mean, this is basically a non-profit organization. Everybody's working for exactly the same goal, and all they're doing by not giving us race starts is frustrating our growth and hindering our growth, which ultimately is going to hinder the process. It's bitterly frustrating and disappointing. And as I said to you, I don't know why. I don't know why we're not getting starts. We've done nothing wrong. We've been good for business. I think we've represented ourselves very, very well. We look very professional. We speak professionally. We present professionally. But no.
And for those who don't know, Rick, it seems from the outside, it can seem as though there's almost like a bidding process at some races, maybe the bigger races, or there's certainly formal or informal conversations with the organisers where you kind of have to present your case. Is that right?
That is right, But yes, that's right. But in the same breath, it's wrong. I mean, surely there should be a process. Surely there should be a selection process. I understand World Tour teams have to do World Tour events. But that's not right either, because in a lot of races, World Tour teams turn up, and they just turn up because they have to be there. Whereas you got teams like us scratching at the door, wanting to do the same event. We don't get the opportunity. Tour Down Under is a classic example. And World Tour only, and it's a shut door. That shouldn't be allowed. They should be forced to play their wild cards, in my opinion, because it's good for the sport. I think teams like us are good for the sport. You know, we get involved, we get into breaks, we're aggressive. You know, I think we're hungrier in many respects.
The biggest surprise really is that you got one last year with the Vuelta, but then having got that, your credentials are even stronger this year.
I think the big question is, why did we get that? If you get it in year one, you don't get it in year two. And we went there, we won a stage. If you look at surveys done by journalists, we got voted, I think the worst we got was 7 out of 10. The best we got was 9 out of 10. Many World Tour teams got 1, 2 and 3 out of 10. So we go there, we win a stage, we do very, very well. We come, I think we were 11th or 12th in the team time trial. And year two, we don't get an invite. It's bonkers.
As an entrepreneur, as someone who's backing this team, does that almost make you step back and say, well, this world is so fickle that, for example, your chances this year of getting those wild cards have been heavily affected by
the appearance of a couple of new teams, you know, a couple in Spain, a couple in France, and it's just very, very difficult for you to plan.
It's impossible for us to plan, and I suppose other people will say, well, look, hang on a minute, you had your chance last year, now give the chance to somebody else. I understand that too, but at least give us a chance. Don't take away all the chances, and effectively this year we have no chances. I'm not saying put us into every Grand Tour, I'm not saying give us every monument, but give us something. Give us one, give us two. Give us something to be able to demonstrate and show our brand. I mean, I think it's a really good story. Obviously, I'm involved in this, so I think it's a good story. But it is a good story. I mean, what we're trying to do is unique. We're the only team that's ever tried to do this, and it's working. I mean, we're getting 20,000 hits a week on our website. Every time we race, we get spikes. When we do the Grand Tour, we were at 40,000 and 50,000 hits. So clearly, the more good races we get, the more big hits we get, the more traffic is drawn to our site. The more traffic to the site, the more transactions. The more transactions, the more revenue. The more revenue goes back into the team and makes the thing sustainable. It just makes sense. So in my mind, it makes sense. Forget me, forget the project. It just makes sense to support the team because we're trying to do something that's good for the sport. I mean, it means if and when the site kicks and it continues to be successful and it generates enough revenue, well, that's the security of the site, of the team, secured. There's no other team can tell you that. They're at the mercy of their sponsor, but this has no sponsor. So, in my opinion, it should be heavily supported, and it's not.
And you know, you launched this team with a very ambitious project just over a year ago. And you talked there about the number of clicks you're generating and so forth, and your idea to generate revenue. I mean, how are you doing against that barometer, against those yardsticks that you set just over a year ago?
In terms of revenue, obviously no. We're not making anywhere near enough. In terms of traffic to the site, we're ahead of the curve. Revenue, we're behind the curve. But we're getting more and more brands on and more retailers on. But again, that takes me back to the original rant in that you're selling this concept to race organisers, but also we're selling this concept to brands and retailers. So if we're not getting the high-profile races and they can't see us on TV on a Sunday afternoon at some big race, then they think, well, you know, this isn't going to work. So it's very, very important that the retailers and the brands see us at these big races to encourage other retailers and brands to come on and encourage the ones that are on to stay on.
I think you said last year that you were willing to fund the team for 4 years. Yes. Does that remain the commitment? And are you sitting here very nervous about what that's going to entail, you know, for your own personal finances?
No, I've said what I've said, and I'll continue the four-year process. But I'm just extremely disappointed and frustrated. I honestly thought that, and I suppose maybe I'm just naive. Maybe I don't understand the sport. Maybe the sport is far more complicated than I originally thought. And maybe I'm not going to succeed. Maybe I'm going to fail. But I'm going to continue trying. And this time last year, we were nothing. And now, as I say to you, we've 15, 20,000 hits a week and growing. We've got over 100 retailers on. We've got many, many brands on. So the concept is working. We just haven't got enough traction.
And from perhaps a naive point of view and maybe a cynical, unfair point of view, people might sit back and say, I've seen this movie before. There was another guy with shoulder-length hair who was a rich guy, and his name was Oleg Tinkov. But yeah, I'm sure you've got much, much better taste than him, Rick, in every sense. And he put a lot of his own money through his companies in for a while, and then eventually just got tired of the whole sport being a mess and him having, you know, no control, no stability and so forth and so forth. Are you adamant that you're not on that curve?
No, I'm not. Look, listen, I'm not trying to reinvent the sport. I'm not trying to change anything in the sport. I'm not trying to do a think off. I mean, he did what he did and will probably continue to do what he does. And good luck to him. That's not what we're trying to do. What I'm trying to do here is just make the thing self-sufficient. So I can stand back and think, God, yeah, we created this, us and our team and the backroom staff created this whole concept that makes a team in cycling self-sufficient. This isn't an ego trip. I'm not about to dye my hair pink.
I think then maybe you'd have got a wild card if you'd done that.
Okay, well, maybe I'll dye my hair pink.
So that was an animated Rick Delaney in Dubai. He is the owner of the Aqua Blue Sports team. Quite an interesting character. Very memorable description you had for him in our forthcoming book, Lionel. Can't remember it verbatim.
I can't actually either. Was it something like he looked like...
I'll tell you what. I'll find it, and you carry on.
I'll
find
it. Well, I don't know whether you'll appreciate this description when you do find it.
I'm almost certainly won't.
No, I don't. It's very affectionate. It's meant very affectionately. But I do have an awful lot of sympathy with what he was saying there in his rant there, Daniel. And I think his point really, on the one hand, you could say, well, you know, cycling, professional cycling is kind of almost adheres to kind of a capitalist system, sort of to a point of self-destruction, doesn't it? I mean, teams come in, they rely entirely on sponsorship or wealthy benefactors, and then they go away again. And there are a few, you know, attempts to develop a self-sustaining model. This one based on retail, Aqua Blue, no bones about it. The team sponsor is, you know, they're trying to shift cycling kit and equipment and what have you. And it seems like the sort of hand-in-hand marriage that should work absolutely perfectly, because people are watching the team, many of whom will be cyclists themselves, may choose to purchase from them in order to support the team. And as Rick says, the money that's generated goes back into making the team stronger and bigger.
Yeah, and I think his major grievance, if he hasn't already spelled it out in that interview, is the lack of transparency about the process. We all sort of suspect, and we've all hinted in the past, that there are various incentives offered to the Grand Tour organisers for picking certain teams, whether they be direct financial incentives or not. And just when we weren't recording actually in Dubai, Rick did say that he wouldn't mind if it was explicitly a financial bidding process, and there was actually a price tag on a wild card, and the teams were simply asked to cough up. I mean, and there is the suspicion, as I say, that is essentially what it is, but the major tour organisers are not open about that. That's probably, the onus is probably on journalists, and perhaps we should take it upon ourselves to actually lay that bare once and for all, what the process is and what it looks like. And you know, the other issue that teams like Aqua Blue face, and all of the aspiring wildcard entrants for the Grand Tours face, is that they've got a gun to their head, in the sense that if they do criticise the choices one year, then they're likely to suffer the next year.
Can completely understand his disappointment. I'm also going to bring a lot of disappointment to our listeners, because I can't find your description, Lionel, of him. You find it was in your Vuelta diary. I remember that much. But you know, in that Vuelta, Aqua Blue were very, very, they were a good story, weren't they? It wasn't just the stage win. It was what they brought to the racing. There was the Conor Dunn story was one that captured people's imagination as well. This tall man riding and finishing a Grand Tour, and Adam Blythe got up there as well in a couple of sprints. So they brought a lot to the race, and you can understand the disappointment. But one of the problems is that you're only a kind of fresh new thing once, aren't you? And there was a lot of interest around Aqua Blue Sport, as there is around any new team. But that luster fades very quickly in cycling, and you know, there are other new teams who capture people's imagination. So it's very easy to feel very very sorry for Aqua Blue in this situation, and hope that they get invitations to some other major races. And just a story I'm reading, chaps, as we record, Gazzetta dello Sport. You may have seen this already, Daniel. You see things on Gazzetta dello Sport very quickly. But they reported on Tuesday that the UCI is poised to refer the Chris Froome case to their anti-doping tribunal, which would really raise the stakes, because he would then have 15 days to explain why there were elevated levels of salbutamol in his system at the Vuelta. So that would really fast forward this whole process and bring a resolution fairly quickly. One can't help but wonder whether this news, and I don't know whether it's true or not, but whether this news, the timing of it, is a coincidence or not, given that Froome is about to make his debut this year, and given that the UCI have been getting a lot of criticism for not appearing to have taken any action or to have moved it either forwards, back, or even sideways. We'll see whether this is true or not, but if it is true, then that certainly raises the stakes, both in terms of the timing, but also in from having an anti-doping charge to answer. At the moment, he has an adverse analytical finding to explain, and there's a subtle but very important difference there.
Yeah, Rich, I mean, it could well be that the UCI is, as you say, trying to bump this whole case along so that it doesn't drag out and drag into the Grand Tour season, the Giro and the Tour de France, which we believe Chris Froome is intending to start both of those races. One other story concerning Team Sky that caught my eye this week, it's an interview by our colleague from the press room for Arrival Outlet Cycling News.
bleep this out.
No, we're not booing Steve Farran. Steve's a lovely chap, and he's done an interview with Fabio Bartolucci, a former Team Sky doctor who worked for Team Sky for around about 18 months, basically talking about some of the policies and practices at Team Sky when he was there, and confirming that the team had used an intravenous recovery program until the UCI introduced its no needles policy just before the 2011 Giro d'Italia. There's a lot of interesting stuff in there, shines a light on some of the practices at Team Sky, but the main takeaway I took from it really was that Team Sky used intravenous recovery. I'm assuming by that he means vitamins and nutrients and what have you, while it was allowed, and then when the UCI changed the rules and banned recovery by needles, Team Sky changed their policy as well.
Certainly, I think we know from comments Dave Brailsford has made in the past that certain policies were relaxed between 2010 and 2011, and there was definitely a lot of pressure from some of the senior riders on the team to be able to do things that, as you say, were allowed within the rules. Because there's been a lot of talk on the back of this interview about grey areas, and we talk a lot about grey areas as well. But I remember a conversation I had with Nigel Mitchell, who was a Team Sky nutritionist at the time, now works for Education First, EF, Drapac, Cannondale. And I asked Nigel about grey areas, and he said there are no such things as grey areas. Something is either allowed or it isn't. I'm not exonerating ourselves here, because we and I do talk a lot about grey areas, but that's certainly one way of looking at it. And as you say, IV recovery was allowed for many years in cycling, and only banned when the no needle policy came in on the eve of the Giro in 2011. Another, just briefly on that, there's been a lot of, the picture, I suppose, of the practices that goings on at Team Sky is building all the time, and a lot of criticism that they perhaps haven't been faithful to their founding principles. But do we judge teams according to how they say they want to be judged, or do we judge teams equally?
Or according to the rules, Rich? I mean, what
yeah, according to the rules.
What Sky said when they launched is essentially it's PR puff, isn't it? Good or bad, as it is for every team when they launch. I mean, it's hot air. It means absolutely nothing what they put out in press releases. It only means anything in the hearts and minds of the fans and how those fans want to interpret it. But the only thing that really matters is the law.
Absolutely. The point I'm making is we shouldn't really judge Team Sky or any team to a different standard than any other team. And yet, that's what we consistently do in this case. We all do. We do as well. We spent hours and hours talking about it. Anyway, that's all on that this week. There'll be more next week because Chris Froome is racing at the Ruta del Sol, and it'll be a big topic there. I hope to bring back some news from that. Any other business this week, chaps?
Well, Rich, there's another story that's been breaking in Italy. The Gazzetta dello Sport have covered it in detail about the Altopack under 23 amateur team and the investigation that resulted from the death of Linus Rumsas last spring. And you talk about grey areas. There are no grey areas, or it doesn't seem, in this story. Six people are being investigated, team cars have been bugged, and it's all very grisly. The substances we're talking about there are EPO, growth hormone, IGF-1, testosterone. And it certainly paints a very dim picture of the Italian amateur scene. I think we all will most of us agree that things in the pro scene have certainly changed and evolved since the 90s and since the early part of the last decade. But reading some of the reports in the Gazetta this week has been a bit like going back in time. And there too, there have been links made with professional cycling, albeit, you know, fairly tenuous at this stage. The team being investigated is a feeder team for Trek Segafredo. I think that what that essentially means is that a few of their riders have been to training camps, and they're one of several feeder teams for Trek Segafredo, and no one has actually become a fully fledged pro from this Altopack team in Trek Segafredo. And then one of the recent developments is a recorded conversation in which it's alleged that Rafał Majka, the Bora Hansgrohe climber, used testosterone when he was an amateur. Don't think he's responded to that yet, but it's certainly these taped conversations, or the transcripts of them, are certainly there in black and white in a magistrate's file on the case. So I'm sure he'll have some explaining that he will want to do.
Unfortunately, Lionel, I have still not managed to find your reference.
Nor have I. I think people just have to buy the book. Buy the book and you can read.
Yeah.
I mean, on its own, that sentence is worth the cover price. I don't want to oversell it, but
it did make me lol when I read it, I must confess.
Well, the book's out on March the 1st, everyone, so do order a copy. Soon.
Yeah, and hope to see as many of you as possible on the road when we do our little tour. Really looking forward to that. In the meantime, I think that's all for this week. We do have a cycling podcast, Femina, to come out very, very soon. That's myself with Orla Shinui and Rose Manley, and some good interviews in there as well. That's out in the next few days. And also Orla's friend special from the Isle of Man is coming out soon. But that's all from us for this week. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
Thank you, Daniel.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us and leave a review on Facebook and iTunes. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by Adam Bowie.